Back together again, you and I chatting it up and wrapping up a very busy week, Friday, April 12th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. We started the show looking at the startling amount of taxes paid by Connecticut residents over their lifetimes, according to a new survey. Connecticut Food Association head Wayne Pesch joined us, responding to allegations of grocery store price gouging in the state. We welcomed Mike Papantonio, co-author of Suspicious Activity, a legal thriller, and finally, former Bridgeport Democrat State Rep. Chris Caruso, as always, checked in with his weekly Friday wrap-up.
All right, your tax day minus 3 days, or minus 3 days till tax day. Today, Friday, the 12th of April, 2024. How are you? Hope all is good. This coming Monday, April the 15th, is tax day here in the great state of Connecticut, the Democratic People's Republic of Connecticut, all over the state, all over the nation. And, you know, listen, this doesn't creep up on you. You know, this is, oh my God, my taxes are due. Really? It's April 15th this year? No, Clyde. It's April 15th every year. And listen, the notion of not paying, well, we shouldn't have any taxes, that's ridiculous. You need some sort of revenue to run your little hamlet, your town, your city, your state, the nation. I get it. And I tied up all my loose ends today. I submitted my paperwork electronically through my arbiter of numbers, my CPA, who I've been with now for 30-something years, something like that. He gets it done for me. He knows the particulars of what I do, this business and all that. And you may do your taxes yourself if you're a single person with no dependents and no business expenses, and you put down your income and you do the deduction and you got the adjusted gross income there, and okay, you look at the graph and here's what I have to pay, and I didn't pay enough, which means you owe, and oh, look at that, I paid way over that, which means you get a check back without interest, of course, from Uncle Sam. So I squared up with Uncle Sam, your uncle and my uncle, earlier today, and I also squared up with the state of Connecticut. I don't owe the state a lot of money. What I do with my state taxes, honestly, is I deduct a little less so I can have more spending money, and I pay the state a couple of $100 at the end of every tax year. It's not much. I do that for New York, too. So the bottom line is, a lot of you folks out there, thousands, millions of you within the sound of my voice, are doing exactly what I did today, what others maybe have done earlier, but what a lot of people, especially if you owe money, what you'll end up doing Monday the 15th, which is tax day. So we talk about taxes all the time, right? And I got into this little chat with somebody here at Connoisseur in the Kitchen the other day. We were talking about, hey, who stays here in Connecticut, who lives in other states? Maybe they were okay with paying the taxes when they were younger, but now they're empty nesters. The kids are gone. They're in the state here, or they live somewhere else. So they go to other states to maybe not necessarily retire, but live out the rest of their years. Maybe they can still do what they want to do, but, you know, it is what it is. And there's a fascinating new story that came out, and I wanted to open with this today. And when you hear some of these figures, it is mind-numbing, some of these figures. And I guess when you extrapolate that many of us, if we get our first job at 16, and if you say work till you're 65 or so, or 66 or 68 or 70, whatever, or in my likely case, 80 or 85, you know, you pay a lot in taxes. But did you ever think of how much you pay? And here's the big question I have today. Are you getting your money's worth? And they all talk about in Connecticut, hey, it's such a great place to live because we have this and that. And okay, I'm not denigrating that in any way, shape, or form. I happen to like it here. I don't foresee myself at my age now, 63, saying, hey, I'm going to pull up my roots and get out of here. But you never know. You just never know. Never say never, as they say. Don't back yourself into a corner. So here's a sobering thought, and this is a story by Daniel DeVise in the money section of USA Today yesterday, and it's starting to get some traction because of because how much money us suckers, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that, how much money we pay in our lifetimes here in the state of Connecticut. Now, a lifetime is a lifetime. It's exactly that. We generally don't start paying taxes until we're 16, and our tax burdens are maybe still there even till the day we die if we're getting taxed on our Social Security, our retirement funds, our property taxes, even though that house may be paid for twice over. You're still generally paying property tax on it, right? Right. So I see this. The average American, let me give you a couple of seconds to think about this. 203-333-9422. 33-WICC. 333-WICC. The average American, average, which means average, that this is a figure culled from all the numbers, lowest to highest. It's not the median. There's a difference. The median is the exact median or halfway mark. The average American pays $524,625 in taxes in their lifetime. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. Now, that's all kinds of taxes. But the average American, according to this new study, pays $524,625. Now, you take that figure and you say, well, all right, whatever, I guess. If you start, you know, let's say you get a job at 16, so you have Medicare tax and Social Security tax taken out, and now a paid leave tax here in Connecticut. You say, well, all right, over 50 years, you know, I get it. It's $5,000 a year, whatever. Well, yeah, whatever, okay. It's according to a new study. But wait till you look at the figures in the Northeast. Now, explain to me if you think you get your money's worth here in Connecticut, all right, the great state, the nutmeg state, the Constitution state, the DPRC, the Democratic People's Republic of Connecticut, the real DPRC. Now, the average American, $524,625. However, in Connecticut, lube up, Maud, in Connecticut, where the average person in the U.S., $524,625. In Connecticut, you ready for this? You sitting down for this? What do you think this is? How much more do you think we pay in the state of Connecticut for all the great stuff we get here? Lousy highways, lousy roads, substandard school systems, a rail system that, although it runs, let's face it, it's slow, it sucks, you know what the deal is. Oh, and we get to live with the second or third highest power costs in the region, in the nation, rather. Whereas the average person pays $524,625 in taxes in their lifetime, we here in Connecticut pay, on average, $884,820. We pay, let me do the math quickly, we pay to say that I love Connecticut. Yeah. That costs us an extra $360,000 across our lifetime. $360,000. But be happy you're not in New Jersey. Because if you're in New Jersey, Garden State residents are getting screwed to the tune of, you ready for this? In taxes. And you wonder why people are angry. If you live in New Jersey, you're paying $987,000 and change in taxes in your lifetime. Washington, D.C., a lot of which is a rat hole of crime, In D.C., they pay $884,000 plus in taxes over their lifetime. Connecticut's third. That was the wrong figure. $855,000. I'm sorry. I said 884. Connecticut's third with $855,000. And Massachusetts, the beautiful Bay State, $816,700 in lifetime taxes. Good God. Had you ever thought of that? I'm sure the average person in this state, now it depends what taxes you're talking about, but I'm sure the average person in this state, I may probably pay all my life, geez, 200, 250 grand, 300 grand. Did you think about that you were number three in the country behind New Jersey and behind Washington, D.C.? Connecticut is number three, $855,000 in taxes. You're in the neighborhood of $1 million in taxes. What are you getting for that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You have some cities that have, you know, by and large, gotten a little bit better. But again, you have some problems that never get better, that never get out of the way. We still have pockets of poverty. We still have pockets of crime. We have a joke of a rail system, right? We have a joke of a rail system. We have suffocating business taxes and business fees. Now, the state employees, they're taken care of pretty well, which is good. I get it. I understand it. But Connecticut is number three at $855,000 over the life of a person there. And Massachusetts is fourth at $816,000. So you tell me, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So do you feel, as you're probably getting, or maybe you filed early, maybe your tax situation was good and you filed early and you said, hey, I got this out of the way 2 or 3 weeks ago, whatever. I did mine this morning. Of course, you know, the library, down the street, Paul. The post office says they're going to be buzzing tomorrow. Are they going to be open Sunday? I have no idea. Monday, it'll be a mass run of the post offices or people filing electronically. But what do you think of that number? Connecticut residents pay the third highest tax burden lifetime in the nation. Behind New Jersey and Washington comes Connecticut at $855,000. Can you imagine that? Now, in West Virginia, they have the lowest burden at $358,000. Now, I know what you're going to say. Well, Connecticut is so much better off than West Virginia. Are we? Well, of course we are, Paul. Okay. But really, are we? To the tune of $500,000 more over a lifetime? All right, coming up at 3:15, we talked about this yesterday. A lot of the Democratic leadership, top Democrats in Hartford, along with Democratic Attorney General William Tong, saying, not exactly saying it, but alluding to the fact that they may think there may be some sort of possible price gouging among supermarkets, the big retailers, and even the other ones in Connecticut, according to some Federal Trade Commission report that came out. A lot of people are saying, hey, time out. Is this all politically timed because of the news about inflation? Joining us right now is a gentleman who advocates for those supermarkets, those food retailers. It's been a while since we've had him on. The head of the Connecticut Food Association, Wayne Pesch, is with us. Hey, Wayne, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
Good. It's been a while. Last time I think we talked was at the tail end of COVID. Yeah, remember those days? Jeez.
we were talking about food prices then.
Yeah. So, Wayne, what do you make of this? And I did see you on some of the newscasts last night. You had the Attorney General kind of, Wayne, this is my opinion. I'm not going to put words in your mouth. This is why I wanted to have you on. Kind of alluding to, well, maybe, and this and the other, and there's an FTC study here. So we want to see your balance sheets. What's up with that?
Well, first of all, it felt a little bit like, shoot first and ask questions later. We were never contacted prior to the press conference to ask some of the questions that they came out with yesterday in the press conference. For example, they talked about meat and poultry prices being driven by inflation and that four companies process 80% of the meat. They were talking about the prices of nuts and eggs being too high and the fact that they can't prosecute up the supply chain. So let's look at grocers. and in reality, Paul, they used the national FTC study that didn't include any Connecticut grocers. The study referenced Kroger, Walmart, and Amazon.
Yeah.
And it calls for further analysis. So I just think to come out publicly like that and kind of take the grocers behind the woodshed was uncalled for.
And when, I thought about it and I just said, well, listen, I live in central Connecticut. I live in Wallingford. So I generally, Wayne, there's a couple of small mom and pops that I go to. But then occasionally, depending upon what I need, what time of the day it is, where I'm heading on my travels of the day, there's a Big Y I go to. There's a ShopRite. There's a Walmart in my town. There's an Aldi. And basically, I can go to a variety of stores, Wayne, and this is just me, uneducated me, saying this. I'm saying to myself, well, aren't these stores all battling, like, on the pennies with each other? Like, I just thought of what I pay in these different stores. I don't see any signs of collusion out there, and I don't think they said they had any complaints either.
They did not, and I think you hit on something that's really cuts to the heart of the discussion in terms of competition. Connecticut is a hyper-competitive food retail market. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have every food retailer that you can imagine does business in the state. They all have different business models. They have different supply chains. They have different margin structures. They all go to market a little bit differently, and none of them talk to each other. So at the end of the day, you're trying to put the best price out on the street for, Frosted Flakes or, Coke 12 packs, because the guy right down the road is going to be looking at your pricing and you have to be competitive. So that's one thing that, you can point to say, well, to say that folks are colluding across an entire market is really unfair. And I think the other thing that is unfair is to paint with such a narrow brush and say, Connecticut's grocers are the problem for the prices that we're seeing in the stores.
Yeah, and Wayne Pesch is the guest from the Connecticut Food Association. Wayne, I don't know whether I mentioned it to you, but over the years we've spoken, my family had a grocery store. Now, it was a little local Italian market. I had an uncle who had that, too. And Wayne, it frightens me because I think sometimes politicians don't get this. We used to have customers that would come in, right? And they would complain that, we were charging 10 cents more on a can of tuna fish or a can of nuts or something like that. And my father and my uncle would very nicely have to explain to them that the reason we had to, charge more is because we couldn't buy the truckloads of this stuff that ShopRite or Stop and Shop can buy. So, as you said, Wayne, just to bring this all around to what you said, everybody has different agreements with wholesalers and with producers.
And different business models. So, for example, you talk about your family's business. Your family's business was built on, service and quality. and you charged a little bit more for that service and quality. That's your business model. You have other business models like you mentioned, Aldi. I don't want to call out any specific retailers,
yeah.
But in terms of the opposite end of what you just described, you have an Aldi who's an everyday low price player. They're not going to go high or low with their products. They're going to try and keep them at the lowest cost possible based on their costs. One of the things that I think that the Democratic leadership and the Attorney General didn't acknowledge yesterday was the fact that, you know, the cost of electricity is skyrocketing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a HUD tax. And I think you and I may have talked about the HUD tax in the past, and that was a tax on diesel trucks, which all distribute food throughout the state, which we opposed at the time because we said that it would drive food costs in Connecticut up higher because it's a Connecticut diesel tax,
mm-hmm.
and that's now in effect. You have, avian bird flu, which is coming and going and driving the price of poultry and eggs through the roof. Mediterranean droughts that are causing problems with olive oils and different types of nuts. And, of course, some of the highest labor rates in the country. This legislature went from 1010 to 1569 for an hourly rate in just 5 years. So there are a lot of cost pressures, and I would tell you that is the reason why people are experiencing sticker shock. And, you know, you made one other point about conversations about
mm-hmm.
the 10 cents in your family store.
Yeah.
Our cashiers and our associates throughout the state, we're at the front line of this. We hear it every day that the dollar's not going far enough, that costs are too high, that I'm having trouble stretching my dollar. We're acutely aware of that. But again, we pay what a manufacturer, a producer, a supplier, a distributor, or a farmer charges us. That's X. We put a margin on that, which is Y, and there's your retail. The real issue is that X, the cost of those products from those manufacturers, suppliers, distributors, and farmers are up substantially because they're feeling those cost pressures as well. And I would add one other point. Wages have not caught up. So now if my groceries over the last 2 years are up 15% to 18%, which is about where that is across the spectrum, I'm not making 15% or 18% more.
No.
So it's real, right? It's real. People are feeling the pinch. And oh, by the way, Paul, it's not just grocery stores. It's food trucks. It's restaurants. It's commissaries. Anywhere where you're buying food, you're paying more today than you were a year ago, and certainly more than you were prior to the pandemic.
And Wayne, I was reading a little bit of what the Attorney General was contending, and they're pointing to this study. And I'm no retail, magnate here, but I did take some marketing and retailing classes in college. And like I said, my family, both immediate and extended, had some of these stores. And there seems to be everybody going nuts here, Wayne, if I read this right, about, the average profit margin after taxes and costs was 5.6%. And now they're going crazy because it's 7%. So it's an extra 1.5 cents on a dollar. I mean, these places have to make they have to make money, Wayne. These are businesses.
Well, that's for some. I've gotten notes from members over the last, 48 hours in terms of that press conference. I had one note say to me, "Yeah, my dollars are up, right? Because I'm charging more. There's right, it costs more, but my profit is actually down."
Wow.
Because people are, they're paying more for stuff, but they're buying less.
Yeah.
They're buying less items. So this is a very, look it, if the Attorney General and the Senate Democrats said that they were going to, post a study with the UConn Zwick Center,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to study the entire ball of wax here, we would support that, right? Because we've got nothing to hide here.
Sure.
We're playing defense in terms of, hey, we've got to go out and explain ourselves now because, those folks went on every media outlet in the state yesterday and basically said that we were price gouging. And they did say that. It's you said they kind of said it. I'm saying they said it.
Mm-hmm.
So Our next step really is to get with the Democratic leadership and with the Attorney General and say, listen, we heard what you said yesterday. We have some immediate answers for some of those questions that you raised, like immediate. And we also can't get to some of the data that you're looking for, but certainly support you guys looking into this. But again, it felt like, and I said this early on, it's like, we're going to shoot now, we'll ask questions later.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's the right approach. And I just think it's, to be honest, I believe it sends the wrong message to consumers.
And you know, finally, Wayne, listen, I know everybody has their path in life, but I don't care whether it's a local city or town council or a board of alders or somebody in Hartford or even somebody in Congress. I get a little winded listening to these people who dictate to a business group. And a lot of these people, Wayne, now some of them have, but a lot of these people couldn't keep a balance sheet, couldn't meet a payroll, couldn't run a retail operation, and couldn't project out costs if their lives depended on it. So again, I understand they have laws to pass and watch, but you know, it's like me telling Aaron Judge how to swing on a fastball. You know, he'll say, "Yeah, that's nice. Okay, yeah." You know what I mean?
Yeah, choke up, Aaron.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. We work very closely with, a lot of legislators, mm-hmm. and I've got a lot of respect for the work that they do in terms of, you know, that can be a very thankless job. And the issue that they raise about consumers paying too much for groceries, that's fair, too.
Sure.
That's fair. I'm concerned. Sure. I have a family. We're all concerned about that. But let's not demonize a specific sector of the economy that is out there swimming as hard as we can to compete and you know, to have a thriving business. And frankly, it was disparaging, really. And,
yeah.
And, you know, it's very disheartening because we need to work with our legislative body, and we need to work with the Attorney General's office and be good corporate citizens, because that's always our goal. And to be called out for price gouging when, in fact, that is not happening, I think that's where we have to really push back with information. And that's our plan, is to really circle back with them and say, guys, listen, we're an open book. If you want to talk about what's happening with the Connecticut economy and Connecticut grocery stores, let's mm-hmm. have a conversation about it.
Yeah, yeah, let's makes sense.
Do that.
Wayne Pesch. Yeah. Wayne, thanks. Wayne of the Connecticut Food Association. I'm sure we'll talk down the road on this. Wayne, thanks. Have a good weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Wayne. Appreciate it. All right. Wayne Pesch, if you want to go online, ctfoodassociation.org, ctfoodassociation.org. And, you know, from time to time, especially on Fridays, I like to kick back, and I love interviewing authors. I love reading books, listening to books. It's how I spend my hours and hours walking, and I'm fortunate to get a hold of some books that aren't out quite yet. And we have one in my hand here that's interesting. The name of the book is Suspicious Activity, a legal thriller. Even though it's a piece of high-energy fiction, it is patterned after what is going on in the headlines today. Mike Papantonio is the guest. He's senior partner at Levin, Papantonio & Rafferty, one of the country's biggest plaintiffs' law firms, one of the youngest inductees into the Trial Lawyer Hall of Fame. He aggressively takes on big pharma, tobacco, weapons manufacturers, and the auto industry, and uses his own cases as springboards for his novels. He was a lead lawyer in the national opioid legislation. He's also a well-known media presence as host of America's Lawyer and founder and former co-host of the syndicated radio show Ring of Fire. And Mike is based in Pensacola, Florida, and by electronic magic, here he is, Mike Papantonio. Mike, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thanks for the invitation.
Where do you find time to do all this, Mike? Man, I can barely write a check to pay the electric bill. What is up with you, man? Do you ever stop?
Well,
what is what?
Yeah, the advantage I have is these books are based on cases that I actually handle, Paul. So it's not like it's a, I mean, I can leave court and say that that is something that should be in a novel. That's something that the American public should know about. Let me work it into this story. So it's a little easier. You're not having to wake up every day and kind of invent something out of nothing. So it's a little easier to write these books.
So
they are based on, everything's based on the actual cases I've handled.
All right, I want to ask you, so before we get to this particular book, do you ever have people, Mike, that you've encountered in court, you know, either on your side of a case or on the other side, or judges or jurors or plaintiffs or defendants, do they ever get a hold of you and say, hey, that thing I just read in your book, was that me? Do they ever do that?
Well, actually, there are a couple of people that are absolutely just drawn right out of real life, but most of them are composite characters. You know, it's interesting to work in this business and work against somebody, and you make a little note. That was really a weird affectation they had, or you run into somebody else, and you start adding all that up, and before you know it, you've got a pretty interesting character. But there are certainly people that right out of real life that are in that book, all my books. This is book number 5, but it's in a series that started with a book called Law and Disorder, and it's the latest is this, and then another one's coming back in January of next year. But they're real people for the most part. They just they're tweaked a little bit.
Okay, suspicious activity, a legal thriller. So what made you write this, Mike? What does it deal with? Was there a specific case? Was there a moment when you said, "All right, book number 5's got to be this"? Why?
Yeah, well, we represent folks that have been killed in. Just all over the planet by banks washing money for terrorists. You might remember the HSBC bank in Europe, where they agreed that, yes, we were washing money. Yes, we knew it was going to result in the death of humans, of Europeans and Americans. And yes, we made $100 billion. And unfortunately, the rest of the story wasn't told, because the rest of the story is that the government let them walk. Nobody was prosecuted. They were asked to pay $1.5 billion. We actually handle these cases, Paul. We represent 2,000, almost 3,000 people who have been victim of this. It's the Gold family in the United States, and it's there in the book. They're talked about in the book, but they don't have a chance really to even have their story told. Most Americans don't even understand how a bank could wash money for drug cartels and wash money for terrorists and walk. And nobody, there's no sense of responsibility. Paul, they don't look like criminals. These CEOs of these corporations and these banks, they don't look like criminals. They're dressed up in Armani suits and they've got a Rolex watch on. So we don't treat them like criminals, even though you mentioned the opioid case. That's the case that I was one of the lead counsel in. They were killing 150 people a day for 10 years. And you know how many people went to jail? None. Zero.
Yeah.
And so all of these books I write are based on, you know, this, just like this. These are real cases that we're handling. And real people who've lost arms and legs, and they've lost mom and dad and sisters and brothers because of conduct directly related to these international banks. And you know what? Corporate America, the corporate media doesn't tell the story, obviously, because these folks advertise with them. There are no regulators to get in the way, because the regulators are part of a revolving door where day one they're working for the government, and day two they're working for the bank. The media does a very poor job covering these stories. So I think that's the advantage of writing a book like Suspicious Activity, because somebody can pick it up, read it, read it in a weekend, and not only come off with a good story, but come off with learning information they had no idea really existed in this country.
Mike Papantonio is the guest. He mentioned the book that he co-authored with Christopher Paulus, Suspicious Activity, a Legal Thriller. But as you've heard now in our first few minutes, and you may have recognized the name, Mike is a very well-known high-level attorney on some mega cases. So, Mike, without spoiling things, we want people to go out and buy the book, but give us a primer here. Why do bank execs do this? Is it the allure of the constant inflow of cash? Do they get bought off? Do they not want to say anything?
The reason they do it is because we have a culture that doesn't perp walk these people. Okay, I don't think you could. You realize the last time that CEOs that stole this kind of money or conducted their lives this way resulted in human death. The last time that anybody paid attention to that was the SNL crisis, where actually Ronald Reagan, of all people, he sent 800 bankers to prison. Since then, there's been this cultural change where we allow these CEOs to do damn near everything they want to do because they know they're not going to go to prison. They pay a fine, right? The HSBC case in this book, they paid a $1.4 billion fine. That was a cost of doing business.
Yeah.
And you want to hear the real ugly part of it?
Sure.
The fine that they paid is actually paid by taxpayers because they write it off at the end of the year. So you ask, why does it happen? How do they think they're going to get away with it? They've gotten away with it for decades since those 800 bankers went to prison back in the Reagan years.
So what happened?
I don't care with it.
So, Mike, the point is, so what happened after those Reagan years? Did these banks say, hey, you do that again and you can forget our campaign contributions, our checks? Is it something like that?
They're very, very close. A couple of things happened. One was Citizens United, and the other one was, it's almost like we think we have a real vibrant Department of Justice, right? Well, think for yourself. The last time the Department of Justice has done anything other than a civil antitrust case where it's – and even then, nobody goes to prison. People simply pay money. So there's this – it's this mentality that exists that too big to fail. You remember that, right?
That
burned down the economy. And we heard – what was it? I forgot. Well, both candidates coming out of that, running into that election, saying, we're going to do something about this. We're going to put some of these people in prison. Nobody went to prison. They stole $8 trillion from mom and pop all over the country. And nobody went to prison. And so it's what happens is it perpetuates itself, Paul. This is a cost. It's simply a cost of doing business. These books that I write, they talk about all the intricacies of that. But more importantly, they're all based, whether it's the addiction case or PFAS or human trafficking. Mm-hmm. These are all the cases that we handle on a national level. Well, it gives you the inside story. And people, the emails and the responses I get on these books is, you know, I had no idea that this is the inside game of American politics.
That must be, Mike Papantonio. That must be, along with the financial rewards and the accolades you richly deserve. That must be pretty special when you get just a common email or a note from somebody. Because most of America thinks, like you said, they know what's going on and they don't.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's too hard to say. It's kind of hard to come to terms with it that you don't really have. You don't have the kind of protection. You don't have the kind of justice system. We say, well, we have the FDA out there, the EPA, the SEC. We have all of these organizations that are working for us. But it's just not true. For the most part, the effect that they have on any on our commerce, on the justice system is minimal at best. And that's because most of them are captured by industry. You know, they today they're an EPA worker. Tomorrow they're working for DuPont Chemicals or Dow, whatever it may be. So these books talk about that. They don't preach about it, but they weave it into the story. This story, it moves very fast. It takes you from point A to point B in a way that you want to turn the page. And I think people will like this book a lot.
And Mike Papantonio, finally, is it safe to say, or were you telling us that even since the Reagan days on up to and through, you mentioned the Justice Department, so obviously all the administrations, left and right, Democrat and Republican, they must know what's going on, right? Or do they or not?
Oh, they do. No. Everybody becomes so tribal and says, my party doesn't do this. I'm Republican. Mm-hmm. They don't do that. I'm Democrat. They don't do that. That's complete nonsense. In the Justice Department now, you have two divisions. One division the way you divide that up is they're the career prosecutors,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
What benefit do they have in taking on complex cases when they can just go after the low-hanging fruit?
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that story is you have a whole division, a separation of lawyers in that department that say, well, I'd like to get a job. Why would I go after HSBC when I would rather be hired by the lawyers who represent HSBC? And so it's something that's it's a fundamental cultural flaw that we have. I don't know what the solution is, other than to say, until we start perp walking people who do bad things in this country, and somebody different from a kid with a hoodie that's on the street corner selling marijuana.
Yeah.
You know, that kid's going to prison. He's going to prison. But if you dress him up in a beautiful suit and, you know, put him in a nice car, give him a Harvard or Yale MBA,
mm-hmm.
we treat him totally different. And I see this every day. I'm across the table of this every day in what I do practicing law. And I simply take that information and put it in a book.
And the latest book, Suspicious Activity, a Legal Thriller. Pick it up Amazon, wherever you get your books. Mike Papantonio, the co-author with Christopher Paulus. Mike, final question before we let you go. Who's going to play you in the movie?
it would be a tough choice.
Come on, name somebody. Come on, give me a name.
They are doing screenplays on this.
Yeah, so somebody's going to play you. Somebody's going to play you.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could give you that image, but I can't.
All right.
But I do think you'll like the Deke character in the book. I think he's an interesting character for sure.
Excellent.
Hey, Paul, look, I really appreciate the time.
All right, Mike. Be good, my friend.
Here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Mike Papantonio. There you go. Suspicious Activity, a Legal Thriller. Man, of course you can see this at the movies. Come on. How could you not? This gentleman helps us wrap up the week every Friday at this time. Chris Caruso, former Bridgeport Democratic state rep. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you? Is there anything in particular that gave you agita this week or not?
When I listen to some of your shows, I do, just some of the topics, you know?
Well, wait a minute. Wait, is that agita inducing or relieving now? I don't know.
It's in the eyes of the beholder.
Oh,
I guess,
there you go. There you go. That's good. That's good political speak, Caruso. I like that.
Yeah,
I like
there
that.
You go.
So we had another. We had another busy week. What's on your mind?
No, you know, Paul. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the state budget. You see what's happening
sure.
there,
mm-hmm.
and the governor's holding back and you know, holding his ground, and yet the leadership of the General Assembly wants to add. I think another, not add so much, but take existing funds and rearrange them for up to about $300 to $400 million. So that's going to be very interesting to watch. I know you've talked about that in the past, but I think there'll be some compromise, but I think the governor will hold, you know, the ground when it comes to the guardrails. And I think he has support of probably the Republican side of the mm-hmm. legislature to hold out to that threat, you know? So it's going to be interesting to watch and, you know, what programs are going to be, you know, help with that negotiation or not for that matter.
Yeah.
But again, UConn comes up and mm-hmm. more money. Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly looks like, Chris, and sounds like if you read into this, as I know you have and seen the governor on all the TV stations and on CTN, it looks like, and not that this is a bad thing, but it looks like, Chris, he takes this personally, like, no, we're going to do it my way. I'm the boss, and you don't tell me what to do. And maybe this is a product, Chris, of him having come from the business world. I don't think you get to his level of wealth, although there was an inheritance there. You don't get to his level of wealth by not taking charge and saying, no, we're going to do it this way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Paul. It's probably his business background. There's no question about it. And him building his own business and knew that there had to be some discipline in doing that. You know, you couldn't spend everything you wanted. You had to be careful on how you spent it. And you had to, you know, build your profit. So I think that's very true. The other thing what bolsters him that past governors haven't had is the support of the Republican side of, mm-hmm. of the legislature. You know, he can, you know, if the Democrats say, well, we're going to go with it anyway, there's not enough to override a veto. So he realizes that, and the Republicans are assisting him. So it's a chess game in many ways, but he has all the pieces at this point. And I think leadership realizes that, because they're not talking about adding new money. They're talking about existing money that's being allocated to different parts of the budget and moving those around to try to accommodate, you know, the growing needs that they have. So it's a classic. It's going to be a classic sit-down negotiation. There's probably going to be some good give and take, but I think the guardrails will hold. And that's going to be interesting for the state to watch, you know, how that all transpires. I know the cost of child care is increasing, and the governor realizes that's a major issue for employment in the state. You know, the cost of education, especially higher ed, is increasing. So there's another area to factor in. So there's a series of issues, but it's going to be interesting to watch, I think. And I think people will get a great lesson in this, really how government should work. It's a back and forth. It's negotiations. And you come out with a deal that's going to work for everyone in the long run.
Absolutely. And Chris, in Bridgeport now, and I've talked about this during the week with some folks here, we have a scenario of the stipend issue with the city council and whether or not, and I mentioned this yesterday with Lenny Grimaldi, you know, is it time, Chris, to just, you know, rework that? I know I guess it would be a change in the city charter, but do we get away from the stipend thing and say, well, okay, here's $20,000 or $25,000? Because, Chris, listen, I know there's a lot of people that say, well, people should do it for the love of what they do. No, it's 2024. I mean, if you want people to carve up, you know, tens of millions of dollars of revenue, I think maybe we should compensate them a little better. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think you have a point there, Paul. You know, when the city council was created back in 1836, their responsibilities were a lot different. Even in the 30s, 40s, they were different. They were probably, even the mayor of Bridgeport at one time was really a part-time position. And it's just increased, and government has gotten more complicated and, frankly, more time needed. So I think you need to do that. I think the problem with the stipend has been the abuse over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had one person actually paid for her brother's funeral. Well, that's not what the stipends are supposed to be about. And I think that's what raises red flags. You know, in the legislature, they give you the salary, but then they give you additional funding. I think it's, you know, when I was up there, I think it was $4,000 a year, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, we had that was reported to the IRS, so it was income. And then you spent it as you needed to. And then you had mileage, for example, for your vehicle. And, you know, especially people that weren't living right near the Capitol. So, yeah, I think you've got to look probably at some type of salary. But I think you've got to put some conditions to it, Paul, as well. You know, ethics standards in Bridgeport. We have a very weak ethics commission, frankly. Not fault of the ethics commission, but the ordinance itself hasn't been changed since 1985, 86. So, you know, we need to put that in place so there's some checks and balance. But, yeah, I think we need to look at it. And if we're going to call it stipend, if that's the word, then there's got to be accounting for that stipend and what can be used the money for and what can't be. I think there's been abuses like that. Now, I know one of the issues now is the council members want to go to these national conferences. And, you know, of course, if it's something related to the job, that's fine. But my only question is, how much do they bring back from these conferences? So if they're going and they're getting information, how much is actually later engaged in the city where we can improve the city? And I haven't seen a lot of that. So I think you always have to be careful with these conferences. They don't turn into a fun junket rather than a learning experience. And there's a lot of money with hotels and airfare and everything else, you know?
And they should go to you know what they should do? Instead of these, like, urban conferences, Chris, send them to a radio conference. They'll come back with stories like you wouldn't believe. First of all, they'll see all of us just drinking, so they can talk about that.
I've never, you know, interesting enough, Paul, when I was on the council and in the legislature, I never went to these conferences.
Okay.
Because I felt, you know, you could get all the information online after the conference. And if you were really interested in making change, you didn't have to go to the conference for that. You could always read, you could research, right? And I, you know, you look at, and I've been looking, like, on Facebook, with some of these conferences. Everyone's going for a massage, going for a tan, all this stuff, and they're posting it.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm saying to myself, what the heck are they doing? They're posting this stuff, you know?
As my mother used to say, stoon on.
Yeah. You know, I think the farthest place I went was Norwalk, Old McDonald's farm when I was a kid.
Wow.
And my mother used to make me a sausage and pepper sandwich on the grinder roll.
Nice, right? Nice,
but these
conferences
have gotten so big, but, you know, that's where all that stipend money.
Yeah.
And again, you know, there are some, I'm not saying all, but there's probably some abuse, and that has to be curtailed. So there has to be standards put in place, even with salaries. You know, what is the expectation if you're getting a salary?
Sure.
Are you expected to attend all your meetings,
mm-hmm.
your committee meetings, and so forth? You know, I ran against second time running against a candidate for state rep. Over 90% he was absent at votes
and
the legislature. And I published that. That came out in the campaign because I felt it was legitimate. It wasn't personal.
Sure.
It was his record.
Absolutely.
And people couldn't get over it. One committee, 100%, he never attended.
Wow.
So, you know, I think in turn, there's got to be some safeguards mm-hmm. put in and a strong ethics, too, that, you know, the money you're earning with the city isn't used, you know, in a situation where fraud could come in, or frankly, an ethics conflict could come in.
Yeah,
so
or
I don't think it's just as easy as giving people money. You know?
Yeah, or do you require them to have, you know, a few hours a week office hours, or do you require them to set up a cell phone or a phone number where constituents can call? Yeah, all good questions. Chris, finally, as we wrap up here, this saga of this empty, what used to be a Stop and Shop on Madison Avenue in Bridgeport. Now I see that the next meeting is just scheduled for April 22nd. Is this thing, Chris, going to become like the pyramids in Egypt? In other words, are people going to come to Bridgeport 1,000 years from now and say, I wonder what that was? Jeez.
Well, you know, it's moving in that direction, Paul. I never looked at it that way, but it is moving in that direction. The only thing, it won't take, you know, it won't take 20, 30 years to build, you know, that like the pyramids did. But, you know, the truth of it is, Paul, with what happens on Madison Avenue is a product of the master plan and the zoning plan for the city of Bridgeport.
Yeah.
And it is fraught with problems in the sense that they're allowing commercial development within residential properties such as this one. And there's no limit. And I've said to council members and others that we need to put a moratorium in, slow things down and look at it. Because what we're doing is, in a way, is we are destroying the quality of life in residential communities.
Mm-hmm.
And because of commercial development. And if you look at some of our surrounding towns, Trumbull, Fairfield, Stratford, they build on the border. You know, most of their commercial development or things like that.
Yeah.
We're building commercial now within residential communities, and the areas of the city that we should be building commercial, we're not. We're seeing more and more nonprofit organizations building, which is tax exempt. We're seeing a use of a lot of land for schools and things of that sort,
mm-hmm.
where we probably shouldn't be taking up that much land because, again, it's exempting of taxes. And as you saw in the paper, and it came out after the election, the grand list in Bridgeport is shrinking.
Yeah.
It's not growing, it's shrinking. So next year, 2025, look out, Mr. and Mrs. Taxpayer, because you got to make up the difference somewhere, and it's going to be on the value of the houses and what they're going to be paying in taxes. So either we get a handle now on what's going on, where we protect commercial development for commercial zone for commercial,
mm-hmm.
and we stop intruding in residential. Where I'm going to make a prediction, Paul, and I hate to do this.
No,
this
go ahead.
My
go
town,
ahead. Yeah.
And I love it dearly, okay? But we are turning into a Detroit. We're turning into a Flint, a Camden. We're turning into cities like that because less and less of taxable property, commercial development, more and more of a high level or a high generation of poverty, and that all leads to the turning of a city.
Mm.
And you're seeing Camden now has actually had an upswing because the leaders of Camden said, we need to turn things around.
Yeah.
Detroit is an upswing now, but Detroit was...
Oh, my God,
you know,
for years.
Yeah,
Bridgeport
is coming close to that, Paul. Our cities in particular are getting to that level. And if we don't address them with zoning, with commercial development and other steps, believe me, we are going to turn into those cities. And I hate to see that. I lived here all my life. I love the town very much. I I served in public office, but I see things like this occurring, and it troubles me a great, great deal. The level of poverty we have in the city is tremendous, you know, and less taxable properties.
And that's
a danger.
Yeah, and it takes years to dig out of. Yep. Chris, thank you, as always. Friday wrap-up with Chris Caruso. Chris, have a good weekend. We'll chat down the road.
You too.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate that. Yeah, I never thought of that with the way the grand list is moving.